Native American tribes and white settlers battled across the West in the 19th century. In our region, one of the more significant conflicts was the Modoc War of the early 1870s. It was largely fought in and around the lava beds of Northern California, now the Lava Beds National Monument. We'll talk about the area in greater detail later in the hour. Right now, we'll talk about the Modoc War itself with Chiwa James. She is a Modoc herself and the author of Modoc, The Tribe That Wouldn't Die, published in 2008. And a former news anchor and host on TV in the Medford-Klamath Falls area. She'll be speaking about reflections on the Modoc War at the Klamath County Museum's Fall Banquet on Friday. Chiwa James, thank you for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, it's really great to be with you.
Very good to have you. You were born apparently on the Klamath Reservation, so you're very much like in tune with this particular part of the world.
Well, I really am. I was born at what used to be the Klamath Indian Agency. It's no longer functional. And what used to be the Indian Hospital today is in disrepair. There's a tree growing up through the porch, but that's where I was born. And there's just really today just a small handful of us that were actually born there. Because, like I say, the reservation was terminated in the early 60s, and so obviously no babies were born there after that.
Now, you once worked at the lava beds, too, I understand. Tell us a bit about that.
Oh, did I ever. I had the Smokey Bear hat, the badge, and I was a ranger. Loved it. I was hired mostly because of my knowledge of the Modoc War and the fact that I am Modoc, and they'd never had anybody there before that was Modoc. So I not only had the knowledge, but I had the emotional part of me that, while I can remember, I used to lead tours through Captain Jack's stronghold, which was, of course, the base of the Modocs. And I'd get up in the morning, I'd put my uniform on, and I'd drive out there, and, oh, here I go again. And I tell you, within a few minutes of getting into the stronghold, something would come over me, and I would feel it all again and loved each and every tour I did.
Well, it must have been a mix of feelings, though. I was going to ask you what kinds of emotions you had, because we're talking about your ancestors here, but you know, a conflict that ended in death and destruction and dislocation.
Well, of course, it was really hard. And you know what was even more amazing? I knew that my great-grandfather had been born during the war itself, but I never knew where. And every time I would go into the lava beds, and especially into the stronghold, I'd wonder, you know, if this was the place that he'd been born. But along with that beginning of life, yeah, the ending of life, the ending of a culture, it was a very sad thing, and I don't think something of that magnitude, I don't think you ever can really get over it. I don't think you ever it can look at be in the lava beds and not feel a wave of sadness. But I got to tell you something. I entered that book as a Modoc, but I came out some 9-10 years later as a human being, because I had huge empathy for the soldiers and the settlers, and I would have to say that my grieving was for everybody involved in the Modoc War.
Really? What changed over the time of the research and the writing?
I tell you, probably the most amazing thing, and this happened back in 1998, which, gosh, was a while ago, wasn't it? But I got an email one day from a woman back in Alexandria, Virginia, and she said to me in this email, she said, you know, I found a trunk in my attic, and there's all kinds of letters from my ancestor who was a soldier in the Modoc War. Would you be interested? Oh, my gosh. You know, I instantly emailed her back, and she sent me the letters of Harry DeWitt Moore, who was a young military soldier, a young second lieutenant during the Modoc War. Beautiful writer. I'm telling you, you can't read his words and not see the suffering that he went through and the people, the soldiers around him. And, you know, he had great empathy for the Modoc. In one of his letters, he said, what am I doing here? You know, I'm fighting against some people that I don't even know what they did wrong or why I'm here. But, of course, isn't this the way many soldiers must feel fighting? But certainly in the Modoc War, Harry DeWitt Moore felt that way. And reading his letters, and there were many, many of them, I felt that I understood so much more about the soldier side. And the settlers, especially the women, oh my goodness, some of their tales of heroism, I don't know how widely people know what these women did, but it was just quite amazing. So, you know, we are all human beings, and I'm a great believer in the value of every human being. And certainly after writing for the many years I did on the Modoc War, I came out with with great empathy for everybody that was involved in this pointless, senseless battle.
Well, I'm going to ask about the pointless and the senseless, but also if the term war is too strong a term. I mean, was it up to that level?
It was a full-blown war. By the end of the war, there were over 1,000 military troops involved trying to rout out, and this was a seven-month battle, trying to rout out some, well, we placed the number between 50 and 60 Modoc warriors, including my great-grandfather, and they had their families with them the entire time. People don't realize this wasn't just a bunch of men out. The women were in the stronghold with them, living in the caves and everything, and there are records of some of the women actually fighting themselves. So, yeah, it was a full-blown war. It was the most expensive Indian war fought in this country, when you consider the small number of Native people involved. And think about it. In 1873, just getting to the lava beds, you know, was difficult for the soldiers. Think about bringing, for example, eggs in. Eggs, the price of eggs just blew out of sight. The lava was so rough on the military soldiers, on their gloves and their shoes, and that's one reason it was so expensive, is where it was and trying to get supplies in and take care of those men who were fighting.
All right, Chiwa James is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. She's talking about the Modoc War of the early 1870s. We'll talk a little bit more with Chiwa about that war and about her coming speech about it coming up this Friday called Reflections on the Modoc War. That's at the Klamath County Museum's Fall Banquet on Friday. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as well. Back here to talk about the Modoc War with Chiwa James in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. We are talking about the Modoc War and the lava beds where they were fought in a couple of separate interviews in this hour. First up, Chiwa James, who is a member of the Modoc tribe and has written several works about the Modoc War of the 1870s. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Chiwa, you've mentioned your great-grandfather a couple of times. Which member of the band was he?
Well, let me say one thing. When you use the term band, you were just right on, because there was never a unified Modoc tribe. They lived in separate bands. And at the very end, just as the military began to crack with under the pressure, so did the Modocs, and they went back into their bands, and they had very separate opinions and did very separate things. My great-grandfather belonged to what were known as the Hut Creeks, and they were in the Wairika area, you know, over on the western side of the reservation. Mm-hmm. It's very interesting. His Indian name was Shikieko, but the Modocs, or the military, couldn't pronounce the Modoc name, so they renamed all of them. Captain Jack was their leader. Boston Charlie was very fair. Black Jim was very dark. Steamboat Frank's mother had a very deep and resounding voice, so he was named Steamboat. Are you ready for this one, Jeff?
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather, and the legend is that his mother was a poor housekeeper. My father claims, and has always claimed, it was a corruption of his Indian name. He was named Shack Nasty Jim. Indeed, that was his name. And when my grandfather was born in Oklahoma Indian Territory, where all the Modocs, the 150 that survived, were sent as prisoners of war, when he was born, bless his heart, he dropped the Shack Nasty and took the Jim and elongated to James. Thus, I'm Chiwa James, not Chiwa Shack Nasty this morning.
That is a good thing.
I think so.
So let's talk about the war's beginning. What happened to bring things to the level where shots were fired?
Let me say this. The Modoc War was a total, complete mistake. It was a confusion of orders. What happened is the military stationed at Fort Klamath was told not under any circumstances to go to battle. And Canby, who was the overall leader, ERS Canby, general, nothing was to be done without his permission. But what happened, some way or another, some of the lesser officers decided that maybe they better do something because settlers were complaining. To make a long story short, totally with no authority whatsoever, a group of them, some 40, rode down to Lost River, into the Lost River country, and they attacked Captain Jack's village. So the war itself never should have happened. And with all the research and studying I've done, I'm telling you, assimilation was already in its beginning stages, but I think it could have worked. The whole thing was a total disaster, and it happened because a couple men just decided maybe they should do something about the problem down there. And people don't realize this was never an authorized war.
Is there a wealth of sources to draw from, Chiwa? I understand there were lots of reporters who covered the Modoc War.
It was one of the most heavily reported Indian battles in American history. The London paper, the New York Times, they just flocked to the lava beds, and lots and lots of material. Now, you have to remember, in 1873, journalism was a lot different than it is today. There was a lot of editorializing. There was a lot of speculation. I know in my book I list some of the funny things I read. I mean, reporters would just say about anything there was to say. So you had to be very careful in writing a book and doing research, because so much of it was not totally factual. But, you know, if you read the same thing over and over and you see it in other places, then you begin to realize it might be true. But, yes, indeed, there were a lot of reports, and the military kept careful track. I mean, there are piles of things, letters written during the Modoc War, so there's a lot of good things. And, of course, in my case, Harry DeWitt Moore's letters, and then I stumbled on one other set of unpublished letters. Those opened up, they opened up things we didn't even know and documented things that needed to be documented. So the two unpublished letters helped, I think, make the book really unique. But, yeah, lots to pull on. Too much. I read a lot.
Huh. With all that coverage, was there some sympathy for the Modocs across the country?
Well, no. The Modocs killed General E.R.S. Canby under a white flag of peace. Although what people don't realize is some years earlier, Modocs were almost wiped out. Remember, they were a very small tribe, and an Indian fighter by the name of Ben Wright moved in and almost exterminated them. He killed some 30 or 40. And so the white flag of peace didn't have a lot of meaning. And Captain Jack, who was their leader, everything the Modocs did was by vote of the people. They were one of America's first and greatest democracies. Everything was done by consensus. So the night before the peace conference, he said to his people, he said, "All right, what do we do?" And a faction of the tribe, who were very, very angry, voted to assassinate the peace commission. Jack pleaded for peace, but it did no good. He had a choice. He could remain their leader and go in to kill, or he could resign his post. So, you know, it was a very sad thing, you know, that came about. But that's one of the things that happened in the war that made people, particularly in the lava beds area, very resentful of the Modocs. They'd killed a general, and they killed a minister, a Methodist minister from San Francisco was the other person killed there. So there was not a lot of sympathy in many ways. And yet, the Quakers is just one example, were very understanding of why they did what they did. And, you know, even to the very end, they stood by the Modocs. And, of course, today, looking back, we have a whole new understanding of what happened. And there's a great deal of sympathy for the Modocs. We understand that the war never should have happened, that they were not treated fairly. And so I think there's a lot more sympathy today than there probably was then.
Chiwa, give us some idea of the conditions for the Modocs while they were hiding out in the lava beds.
Oh, my goodness. It's amazing. They were in the stronghold, and during the periods between the first battle for the stronghold and the second battle for the stronghold, which was several months, things weren't too bad. They were able to have food brought in. They did it in their own way. You know, they had people slipping in and out. But once things really picked up and once the battle really progressed, food became scarce, but even more importantly, water. You know, I was a ranger there. Man, there was no water in that. It would rain, and the ground would just go and suck it up. There was ice in some of the ice caves, but they depleted that, and they were starving. They had no water, and they Can you imagine having all the soldiers after them, and they had their women and their children with them, and there are accounts of the old people that could hardly make it, and children under seven were the only ones that could be carried. If a child was seven, they had to walk. I mean, what psychologically must it have been like for those families? And remember, they had no child psychiatrist with them to help those kids along. It must have been brutal. And it was. And when they finally, the war ended and they were captured, they were in pretty sorry condition.
What? So you mentioned the assassination of General Canby, which would seem to be a clear turning point of the war. How quickly did things escalate after that?
Oh, did they ever? Within days, the second battle for the stronghold took place, and it was powerful. I mean, the first battle for the stronghold, there were some 300 soldiers. Remember, there's approximately 55 MODOK warriors in there. But by the second, and from then on, the numbers just accelerated of the military coming in. And remember, for every MODOK that fell, there was nobody to take his place. For every soldier that fell, they'd ship more in. And so the numbers increase and increase. As I said, at the end of the war, there were over 1,000 involved, not all chasing the MODOKs. They weren't sure where they were even, but in some facet or another, there were 1,000 of them involved in some way.
All right, we're talking to Chiwa James here on the Jefferson Exchange. We'll keep around for a few more minutes talking about the MODOK War of the 1870s. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I understand there were some other Native Americans working with the federal troops.
Yes, there were. They had, for a while, they had the Klamaths. And, of course, the Klamaths and MODOKs had always been not really on good terms. They didn't fight each other, but they weren't really good feelings. And during the MODOK War, the Klamaths at one point in MODOK Klamath, their language was very similar, yelled up to the MODOKs, and they said, hey, you guys, you know, we know where there's some guns, some ammunition. And at any rate, the government found out that the Klamaths had kind of turned around and were supporting the MODOKs. And I got to tell you, the Klamath scouts were never again hired by the U.S. government in an Indian war. And then the Hot Springs Indians came in, the Natives came in, and they served as scouts throughout the rest of the war.
So when and how did the fighting finally come to an end?
Well, it finally, just sheer numbers. I mean, if you keep shipping men in, this is an amazing thing. There were very few MODOKs killed in battle. I would have to say this, not because I'm a MODOK, but because it's well-researched. As military fighters, they were unbelievable. Their strategy, the way they fortified the stronghold, they were superior in their warfare. But sheer numbers, after a while, you know, wore them down. And then I have to keep reminding people, because most don't even realize it, that there are women and children with them. You know, how would you feel if your kids were there and there were bullets flying around? So I think the MODOKs wanted out of it but by that time they were in so deeply, you know, it was hard to know how to get out of it and what to do. So they fled the stronghold, and supposedly nobody could get out of the stronghold because it was no man's land, but the MODOKs knew the land. In fact, they were guerrilla warfare fighters before that term even existed. They used the land against the enemy, and that's why they were so successful. But they slipped out, and they slipped down into the southern part of what today is the Lava Beds National Monument, and the military, of course, took pursuit. But bit by bit, one group after another surrendered, until finally only Captain Jack was left in his band. And it ended, you know, in June of 1873, it ended. And in October, in fact, it's October 3rd, which is coming up, Captain Jack and three of his warriors were hung at Fort Klamath. 2,000 people showed up to watch the hanging. Not only were all MODOKs required to be there, including the families of those four men, but get this, in Ashland, they dismissed some of the schools dismissed classes so parents could take their kids over the mountain to watch the hanging. That was the thinking of those times.
Wow.
You know, today we can't even imagine that, but that's what happened. 2,000 people saw that. And October 3rd, interestingly enough, I live in Sacramento, but I'm traveling up to Klamath Country, and the MODOKs the descendants are having we're honoring, we're commemorating Captain Jack on October 3rd at the grave sites, and that's never been done before. And then the public is welcome from noon on. But,
This is quite the public spectacle, this hanging. I mean,
Yes. And when you read about it in the papers, I mean, and even the Modoc War was on the front page of the New York Times many times. I mean, it really was a highly publicized war, and it got bigger. And because they couldn't defeat them, you can imagine, you know, David and Goliath, the headlines read, and, you know, it was great material for a journalist.
We have a call here from Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chiwa James from the Modoc Tribe. We're talking about
Good morning, guys.
Hi.
I have a question. There's stories that there was an Army payroll that was stolen, about $50,000 in $20 gold eagles. Any truth to that? And
you know, I couldn't quite hear
bed.
The first part of your question. Could you repeat that?
There was a rumor about gold being stolen, Army payroll. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Let me tell you an interesting thing. Jenny Clinton was the last survivor of the Modoc War. She died in 1950 at the age of 91. And as a child, I used to go up on the Klamath Reservation every Sunday and visit her. She claimed that the Modocs had gold. They had sat. Of course, this was during the gold rush, so, you know, there was gold floating around then. But she said they had a large amount of gold. They had saddles and had ammunition. And as they fled down into the southern part of the lava beds, they hid it in a cave, very carefully hid it. I mean, this is the only knowledge I have of any gold. But they hid it in a cave. And Jenny Clinton, one Sunday when we were up there, we were prepared to take her into the lava beds to find that cave. She was totally blind, but she told my dad, she said, "I can find it." And so we took off, and it began to rain, turned into a downpour. We took her back home, and she died shortly thereafter. So that's not a complete answer to your question, because I can't really document or tell you whether that exactly happened or not, but I do know there was some gold involved in some way.
All right, so we talked about the hangings then of Captain Jack, Shaq Nasty Jim.
No, Shaq Nasty Jim was not.
Oh, that's right. Okay, right. Okay.
He and 150 of them were put on trains, and they were sent back to Oklahoma Indian Territory, and they resettled there, and they were prisoners of war until 1909. And I'm enrolled. There is no Modoc tribe. I'm enrolled with the Modoc tribe of Oklahoma, and there were Modocs that were not shipped back to Oklahoma Indian Territory are enrolled with the Klamath tribes. And we have the same ancestors, but we live in totally different parts of the country. And as I was writing the book, I would find people of my own tribe with the same pictures as the people up at the Klamath Reservation had, and they didn't even know each other.
Interesting. So, but there were no Modocs in Oklahoma. I mean, the only reason that there's a Modoc tribe in Oklahoma is because that's where the Modocs were shipped.
They were
right?
All sent back. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. What I was getting at about the hangings of Captain Jack and the other three men was there was some disposition of their bodies that might be somewhat distasteful.
Oh, my
to
goodness.
People.
Supposedly, they were buried, near Fort Klamath, which today is just at the base of Crater Lake at Fort Klamath, that little town of Fort Klamath. But what really happened, and it's been well documented, believe me, the four heads were removed, and they were placed two to a barrel, and they were sent to the Army Museum back in, I think it was Washington, D.C., and there they remained, and then the skulls were sent over to a Dr. Angel, who was with the Smithsonian, and they sat up in his office for years, and then as the climate in this country changed and we became a little more understanding of the remains of Native people, those four heads were claimed by an individual of who lived on the Klamath Reservation, who was with the Klamath tribes, and she took them, and although the Klamath tribes has repeatedly tried to get the four heads back, she's refused to return them, and nobody knows where they are but her. So we know the bodies are there, but we don't know where the heads are.
How well is the timeline of the Modoc War arranged in the lava beds itself? I see from Lee Jularaw's book. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes here about there's lots of plaques out there. It appears.
Oh yeah, they have. Now you're talking about they have the plaques with the listing of all the people that participated in the Modoc War, And then there's, it's like any national park. There's plaques everywhere talking about what happened. General Canby, the cross is there. It still remains. And the cross is there. Gillum's Camp is well marked. And, of course, the lava beds, as you travel through the lava beds, you actually have a little tour book that you can use and follow as you go through.
All right. Chiwa James, I want to thank you so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange to talk about the Modoc War. Chiwa will be back in the Klamath Basin on Friday to deliver an address called Reflections on the Modoc War at the Klamath County Museum's Fall Banquet. That'll be Friday, October 2nd. Chiwa James, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about the Modoc War.
Loved being with you and all the people up there.
All right. Take care.